Welcome back, everyone. This is Eric Ellison with the Digital Education Podcast, where I have opportunities to have conversations and talk with innovators, leaders, educators, and people who I just get to know in unique and sometimes random places. But it's been a little bit of a time off this summer, the month of July, but there is a common thread that I think I've been seeing as I look past over some of the prior podcasts with Rob Lowe, Daniel Pompick, Dave Hill, and we're going to get into that today with Ann Snyder too, in regards to character and the fabric of character. Ann is the editor-in-chief of Comment Magazine and a writer and convener devoted to questions of class and culture, beauty, and beatitudinal faith, which I think is a really cool term. Ann has directed the Philanthropy Roundtable's Character Initiative, a program seeking to help foundations and business leaders strengthen the middle ring of morally formative institutions. And today, most of our conversation is going to be around her pathbreaking guidebook, The Fabric of Character, A Wise Giver's Guide to Renewing Our Social and Moral Landscape. But before we go there, Anne, in your bio, it talks about the middle ring of morally formative institutions. What does that mean? And help us understand kind of this context of even some of these kind of morally formative institutions in the work that you do.
Sure. No, happy to. Thank you. So the middle ring, I wish I could claim credit for that phrase, but it's definitely not mine. It's an old idea that Tocqueville noticed. He wouldn't have used the phrase middle ring, but it's sort of a cute way of describing like the distinctives of American civil society. So just all of those kind of voluntary associations that historically I think have been a unique part of kind of American life. The classic kind of cliche examples are the bowling club, your local volunteer effort, sort of community policing. But then it's like less institutionalized forms, like who your neighbors are. And so anyway, it's the middle ring. There was this guy a number of years ago named Mark Dunkelman who wrote a book called The Vanishing Neighbor. And it was kind of, I think it came out in like 2014 or maybe 15. And it was a diagnosis of sort of how, it's kind of an update on Bob Putnam's Bowling Alone study back in the late 90s that, you know, we've only continued to erode in the U.S. our sort of neighbor knowing neighbor, and that kind of level of relationship has disappeared. So what we have instead is, so he said, as human beings, like all people everywhere have kind of different emotional capacities for different kinds of relationships, and the inner ring would be the most intimate, like family, a few of your closest friends, like people you see on a weekly, if not daily basis and talk to, and you share most everything with. And then the middle ring is like the people you see on the street, you see them fairly regularly. It's your local, you know, I'm thinking kind of idyllic small town term here, but it's like your local barber. In my neighborhood, there's an amazing Korean family that actually has this little like market, and we know each other, and you know, it's just she would know if I were to have a surgery, but I wouldn't necessarily divulge to her the deepest parts of my life, but I might divulge some of the crisis moments that require help from others, like practical help. And the cool thing about the middle ring, there's this, I think it's Dunbar's number, I may be getting that wrong, but Dunkelman did this study, or someone did the study that he quoted, of all around the world, the best way to understand what the middle ring is that anyone who sends a holiday card in December, their address list around the world hovers right around 150 people, 150 addresses. And that number is like, those would kind of encompass the middle ring. And then the outer ring is like Facebook acquaintances and all business cards we get, you know. So his argument was that we have somehow lost the middle ring. We have the inner ring. Most people have the inner rings pretty intact. And then a lot of us have, you know, outer rings, but those are more transactional relationships. So what's happened to the institutions that historically gave us kind of that, on the one hand, just sort of practical interdependence. And so that's that's why I use that phrase, because I kind of captured my imagination as I even thought about my own life and what I had in abundance and what I didn't have. And I did at some level like yearn for some of these more commonplace relationships that, you know, wouldn't necessarily be profound every single second in conversation, but were like full of levity and practical aid and, you know, just sort of that invisible safety net around you that I think is just a, you know, is a deep comfort as you go about your day.
That's really helpful for me to hear, because it fits so much with the book you wrote and kind of this idea of the fabric and the interconnected nature of character and character formation, and how, you know, I think there's this really interesting, you know, point in the book where you talk about one of the organizations and there's this statement that, oh, it's your choice alone, but it's not your choice alone, or it's not the work that you do alone. And so like, how did you find these case studies or these examples of organizations that really kind of fit, you know, maybe fit into this middle ring of our society as they build, you know, build that character and build the fabric of these relationships?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it was, I don't know. I should have kept exact count of how many places I visited. I began the project with just a running assumption that we're not just formed, our moral character is not only formed at age 5 or 12 or 14, but actually there may be acute periods of our lifespan where are just like very formative, and psychologists and neuroscientists and others would say, yes, these are the magic years when all the really important stuff happens. And then after that, it's like negligible, but I get that. But my view is like, look, every sphere we're in changes us a little bit for good or ill. And yes, we have moral agency and we make choices, but those choices are often preconditioned on a whole series of influences. And in the very environment where you work, where you go to church or synagogue, or where you play sports or whatever, the team, great team, or a sports team that gossips all the time. I mean, there's every sphere has its own character as a whole, and that character will inspire often. You echo it, you emulate it. So that was kind of my running assumption, which meant, unfortunately, that I had cast for myself a specific ocean of source material. So I just went as many places as I could find. And I basically just, you know, told everyone I'd ever known in my life. I sent out a mass email, like, here's what I'm working on. I need a lot of help because I have a huge learning curve ahead of me. If you know of a place that you feel like is either in dramatically changing people in the direction of the good and or gradually over many years, just please give me a name and I'll see if I can go visit it. So that's kind of what happened. So I went to schools and rehab communities and AA groups and prisons and companies that are really either boast and or just have a reputation for having a very intentional culture for their employees that's oriented in XYZ directions, universities, neighborhood revitalization effort. I mean, you name it, like artistic communities. And I, you know, at first I didn't totally know what I was looking for. I knew that I wanted to kind of look at this dance between the role of an individual's choice, say if you had a certain moral dilemma, and then how the community did or didn't help you make that choice, or at least train you to make it in the right direction. But in retrospect, this is really how I feel. I was just a student of, I was just a student of a wide range of kind of formative practices for very different constituencies. Like working with men and women who've been in prison for 25 years is a very different thing than working with 6-year-olds who, are still relatively innocent most of the time. But there, I just started noticing that the places that, you know, frankly, at a very basic level where I would visit, and even though I was sort of the journalist that was meant to be a neutral sieve and not at all emotionally invested, if I would spend 2 to 3 days at a place and find my own self, frankly, behaving with more, just just wanting to be the best, regardless of whether anyone was looking, you know, to be honest, to be joy-filled, to be kind, to be selfless, to be self-sacrificing, et cetera. Just even at the simple level of like, wow, I sort of walked away like a little, more ennobled than when I came in. That was a signal to me, which I know doesn't sound very scientific, but it would whet my appetite I would be intrigued to keep going into the organization. And you just start finding people. Typically they're the leader, they're the principal of the school, but often they're, you know, they could be just a teacher who's been at this place for 30 years, or, you know, in one case in the book, there's this guy who was in prison for a long time, and then he kind of had this dramatic transformation over this 8-year crucible period at something called Delancey Street. And then he helped start and lead this replication of this rehab community in Salt Lake City. They just have a moral fluency. And so the combination of kind of their own personal character that was less evident necessarily in any words they said, and more just how I watched them behave with others and how I watched them lead, paired with then how they described their process. I mean, I just was a sponge, because I think, you know, maybe that I'm living in Washington and we're just a hopeless case out here, Washington, D.C. But I just feel like I don't mean to sound like a grandmother here who's lost all hope, but I just think we have really lost like comfort with more, even just moral vocabulary. And so people who could self-confidently kind of declare, well, this is what we believe the good is, and there could be different ways of achieving the good, but we're going to say that there is such a thing as a good, which means there's also such a thing as, you know, a disordered good. So I think I just was drawn to people who were, kind of had a moral, and then I think it's easy for most of us, if you've been around the block a little bit, to sort of tell when a collective whole is healthy and when it isn't. So it is as much a book in some ways, and my work really is as much about what actually shapes character in the 21st century as it is about, well, the very things that shape character, you can pretty much count on them also being somehow like very healthy organizations that we'd all want to be part of.
Yeah. And so that's a little bit, you know, kind of, I mean, and you hit on it in so many ways, you know, whether it's clarity of purpose or just even, you know, the investment of a leader, or, you know, the interconnected nature of these types of things. And you lay out in your book, I thought it was interesting, 16 questions, you know, an organizational guide for great character formation. And so it's this really interesting process of, number one, like me asking these questions of myself, but then two, asking these questions of my institution and, you know, and of what I, you know, where I have leadership capacity or where I have impact. And then really three is somebody who, you know, whether it's, you know, a supporter in a traditional donor sense, or you've written this, you know, from a philanthropy standpoint, is if I don't have the time, or if I hear about something that like strikes my interest, or somebody says, hey, you need to check this out and get involved, or, you know, even make a career change or job change to go and spend time with this organization or in this place, like of those 16 questions, and you've touched on a few of them, like, what are the ones that you look at and say, you know what, as you dig in, start here?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. Thank you for asking it. So what I would say is, I think I'm going to pick three, maybe four. I mean, obviously, the reason why there aren't fewer of them is I think they're all important. I couldn't narrow it down at a certain point. So every pastor I know, let alone CEO, they're all like, yeah, you really should have done a 3 points, not 16, but well. So the first thing I think I've just continued to come back to is paramount is this, and I use kind of a fancy Latin word, but telos, like does, just asking the organization, whether it's your own or one you're considering working for or volunteering with or, you know, whatever. And by organization, I'm using that loosely because I was actually referring to a wide variety of initiatives, and some of them are heavily institutionalized and some aren't. But telos is the idea that you have kind of this just orienting end, like you really know why you exist and what ultimately kind of animates every decision. And surprisingly, and this gets a little bit to what I was saying with, I feel like our language as a society is, we kind of lost like moral thickness and richness as we talk about, why we do what we do, why we should care about serving the poor in a certain case, or why, how might safety be achieved in this neighborhood, or, you know, name your kind of ambition. There's often, I find, like an inability, we've lost the muscles almost to dig into like fundamental orienting ends, maybe because often, like, if you're going to have, I call it a transcendent end, it doesn't have to be religious, but lowercase t, maybe because we're uncomfortable, like kind of goes to what I was saying earlier, uncomfortable just declaring out loud the nature of what the good is. But so anyway, so I would say telos is like kind of everything always comes back to that. Does it have a clear, strong reason for being in the world that everyone who's a part of this organization knows and embraces? Like, you think the military, you know, that's a very existential thing. You're here to serve the country, and the country believes XYZ. You know, it's profound when you really think about it. And I think that is an orienting axle for everyone to feel like they belong, shared mission, etc. And there's something, and I'm sorry, now I'm derailing a little here on the answer, but I think a lot these days around, like, you know, how does the country ever get united again? And where are we seeing examples of unity across difference? And there's something about a shared project or a shared end that's hugely powerful for enabling, surprise friendships, let alone collaborations and other things. So that'd be number one, telos. I think the second one that I would lean on is this issue of healthy relationships. And this kind of gets to the whole communal flavor of the book, which is probably a little unusual for someone looking at how individuals' character is shaped. But, I think we are in a society almost at all levels where achievement and the meritocracy have become kind of our MO of how we understand what's important and what matters. And I was so drawn to organizations that were kind of countercultural and saying, yes, but like ultimately excellence needs to be in the service of love, and excellence needs to be in the service of, you know, to use a religious word, you know, sort of like a shalom, like an interdependent harmony. And there are certain conditions and rituals you can lay out or enact in any given organization that will foster healthier relationships. And that's going to be the foundation for our success. And I think you find some for-profit companies that understand this. It's not just the nonprofit world that would speak the relational language, but, you know, the tricky thing is, and especially I found this trying to help philanthropists think in relational terms, these days everyone wants to measure, you know, you want to get numbers to stuff so that you can feel confident funding it. And it would be wonderful if we developed like a whole field of social capital that understood how to sort of measure the quality of relational health. I don't know if we're there yet. I'm also not sure it need only be a quantitative thing. But anyways, yeah, relationships, so TLS relationships. And then I think this is just happens to be my favorite one. I just, as a sign that something really right is happening, like, is there joy? Do you sense just like a deep ease with newcomers? Is there like sort of this inexplicable fragrance in the air that is life-giving? And I think, you know, joy is hard to define, but I think we know it when we see it. It's deeper than happiness, and that's just usually, you know, good fruits tend to suggest good roots. And then the fourth, and I'll end here, is just I call it generativity, which is just, you know, when if you're interested, so there's all types of organizations, and I'm not saying every organization needs to transform you or deeply form you, but insofar as I feel there's a lack of those out there and we need to encourage more of them, if you're looking to try to discern, say you're a donor or you're a leader of something, and you're a president of a university and you're trying to understand your impact on your graduates, a good question is, well, what kinds of, if we feel like we have a good culture here and we're imparting something worthwhile, are our graduates producing something similar wherever next they go. So the example I often think of is this college that I fell in love with years ago in New York City. It's called NIAC. It draws mostly from the outer boroughs of New York City. So a lot of immigrant kids and African Americans, and then there are some that come from overseas. But so basically it's like a very non-white place, and yet the school like hums with deep care for the other, and a lot of the students go back. It's a very social service oriented place, so they become nurses, teachers, they serve in homeless shelters, crisis pregnancy centers, prisons. And so anyways, the second day I was visiting the school, so this was quite a few years ago, I just was so struck by the like deep level of care that was, I don't know, was unusual in a college to feel in the hallways, and especially like right near Ground Zero in New York, in Manhattan. And I asked the faculty, I said, what, you know, if the employers that hire NIAC graduates were to tell you what, you know, if there's a pattern they've seen in them, or, you know, what would they say about your graduates? And interestingly, like three faculty members almost in unison said, oh, that's easy. Employers tell us that our graduates create mini NIACs wherever they go. And I just thought that was such a powerful statement of kind of cultural ripple effects, that when you're imprinted by a place that has sort of a thick ethos, whether it's rooted in love or order or self-sacrifice, you know, name kind of what the overall ethos is, and the people then that go on, often without the support of your peers you were with, but to new places, that somehow they're empowered and inspired and even equipped to see a similar culture elsewhere. So those four. Sorry for the long answer.
No. And it's so perfect, because I think, you know, part of the conversations that I've been having, especially, you know, on some of these, but, you know, especially that last one, the generative nature or the duplication of some of this, it is really kind of intriguing to me. It's been interesting to watch, because I think even some of the generational things that we're going through and generational transitions in the United States is, you know, where is the place where, you know, you kind of have these growth opportunities. And then I have a group of friends that we talk about innovation all the time, and how do we innovate, or how do we change, or how do we even prepare for, you know, just innovation cycles within existing organizations. And you talk about this generative idea, but then also in the book you mentioned, you know, that scaling up, and there was a quote in the book from one of the leaders of the organization, that scaling up or modeling or creating a model that just kind of goes, you know, to a larger scale is incredibly difficult. And you know, in a lot of these places, you've visited places that are meeting the needs of a community or meeting the needs of a certain area. And then it is generative, where you talk about the one that, you know, he has this transition, you know, this transformational experience in LA, and then takes that to Salt Lake City. Or, you know, there's this idea that you have these sorts of schools in Indiana and Indianapolis area, and then, you know, where can they kind of also be transplanted or transform? You know, as you enter into these innovative places or these places that are trying new things, and then you even mentioned the university with Dr. Hatch, and you know, he talks about, you know, what we want it to be attractive. We don't want it to be mandatory. We want people to choose in, you know, rather than trying right. to opt out. And, you know, as you look at these sorts of organizations and these thick organizations, what have you learned about just places that you would support, places that you would get excited about, or just even for us as we build them and grow them, that, you know what, the work is innovative, it's local, and, you know, you start from the grassroots rather than maybe from this big national or big picture model, kind of do this to everybody.
Right. Yeah, no, I thanks for that question too. I don't want to sound anti-scale, even though, frankly, throughout this work, I found myself biased to be kind of against scale, mostly because you can't take away the particularity of people's, you know, when you think about it, for many of us, you know, our initial most formative moments are often with mom, right? Like the first few months of all of our lives. And like, that's very, on the one hand, ideally it's a universal relationship, the role of a mom and a baby and so on, and whatever's going on and those, like the power of that attachment. But you know, it's also, each mother is very unique. And I mean, that's sort of a silly thing, you know, silly example here, but there's a particularity of the stories your grandfather told you when you were 9 years old, of the mishap you had, you know, maybe being bullied on the playground at age 12, you know, the particular, you know, relationships in your neighborhood and so on. Like there's just a distinctive quality to all of this that it's a little hard to brand and institutionalize out. Now, obviously 100 plus years ago, we had huge institutions built, starting very much with national ambitions. So the Boy Scouts and the YMCA and, you know, and you had other more sort of civic oriented things like the temperance movement and the settlement house movement. And these things kind of spread eventually like wildfire, and they were heavily institutionalized. And there was, in the Boy Scouts case, which I actually do write about in the book, that it's sort of its history. Its genius was that it was both national and very federated. So a lot of trust was given to local context and the particular needs and sort of preferences of each context, which I think actually to its credit does very much continue to this day. But for reasons, you know, I think, we live in a time where, you know, we're very diverse as a country. It's a, you know, this was an American focused book. So I guess I had some limits there in focus, but we're even just as a country, we're huge. Our politics alone shows, just if I've learned nothing the last few years, it's that we are living not just in two Americas, but like 12 radically different Americas at least. And, you know, that's not to say that I'm against, it would be wonderful if we like shared as a whole society, you know, sort of shared definition of the good. But I think it feels, at least on the surface, like that in and of itself is in such contention. So I think the combination of like real moral pluralism writ large, let alone cultural diversity, mixed, I don't know, for reasons that I'm no expert on, you know, I think there's a younger generation that's come up that's really distrustful of the national and much more trusting of the local and the proximate and something you can sink your hands into. And I'm a little closer to that younger group. So I think all of that kind of fed my deep desire to encourage philanthropists instead of being discouraged by the fact that maybe we're just, at least now, we're not. If you want to do deep moral work in people's lives, you probably shouldn't try to tackle it from a let's go big level. You have some place, you know, you've got some decent, I would call them decent, I wouldn't call them amazing, you've got some decent things like KIPP schools and that kind of model that actually have a character component. Work hard, be nice, I think is their tagline. But from what I understand so far, I mean, it's like fairly thin. And they're you know, they're not necessarily oriented with character being the protagonist. They're trying to help kids from really tough backgrounds get to high school graduation. So that's a different kind of goal, which is very worthy. And that can kind of nationalize, but there's just something about character formation that is deep, hard. There's no shortcuts to it. You can't be formulaic about it. It's this very delicate dance between with particular relationships, particular experiences of struggle, and then very particular causes and contexts that are greater than yourself that you want to serve. And I think all of that points to, I know you want to affect the greatest good for the greatest number, but there is, and that's why this generativity thing is so key to me, is like if you can change a few lives in your place, you just don't know. I mean, it's a little like fire embers. Like they could, you know, you don't know where people will move and who will inspire. And we live in enough of a, I think, disaggregated age because of the internet and so on. There's a little randomness too. So I guess I'm pro deep formation, which means I just believe in it at the sort of small local level, and then believe in kind of the ripple effects from there. And I, you know, maybe this is the next chapter of my work, but figuring out, okay, well then how do we pair some, like if say these questions that I've laid out, like these 16 questions of what makes for a really formative community, if I could get enough people to sort of buy into those, is it networks then? If we're no longer going to be in an institutionalized age, is it networks that are going to kind of be the incubators of these ideas, but still seeding it in really local ways? So I really have more questions than answers, but I hope if there's anything scalable, it's like a logic here of what makes for a thick moral community, that logic could somehow spread like wildfire, and then people would figure out what it means to, what it means for them, what kinds of rituals and liturgies, for instance, should they instill in their, weekly neighborhood gathering or whatever, what might it look like to create higher peer-to-peer accountability? I think if you kind of name these first, what I'm calling first communal principles, then ideally, so maybe it's the marketing. Maybe I just need to market this. See if I believe in it. I don't know, but does that make sense? Like scalable logic, but not scalable programs.
Yes, it makes complete sense. And I mean, the interesting thing that I've been wondering about or thinking about, and this book continues to help me kind of wonder and think about, because I think the questions just kind of continue to grow, as you read it. And I love the fact that you put these it's not these 16 things to do, but there's these 16 questions to be asked. It's this process of asking those questions of yourself, asking those questions amidst a group, an institution, an organization, whatever it might be. And I sometimes think about it, because I've watched it in my life recently, in particular, if I go to just the individual level of like communities and neighborhoods and organizations, we tend to be really good in crisis, periods of crisis.
When
someone's in significant need, and sometimes I wonder about like some of this, and as I was reading it, it's like, okay, but I love life, and I love my life and where I live and what I get to do, but most of it's, it's like, what does this mean in the mundane daily work of what, I just keep kind of cycling through and building and growing and developing and so these questions really kind of even get to, okay, I'm prepared. Hopefully I'm prepared for those crisis times, and then I have those, but if I don't, that's an interesting conversation, but what does it mean to build this character and build this fabric in the everyday, what seems sometimes as just the mundane efforts and work of our life?
Right. No, I love that. I think that's part of why you actually just made quite a profound point. What you just said, I think that part of why I even focused more on the communal elements of, like, I just couldn't divorce individual character and its formation from the communities of which we're a part, is that at least at some level, ideally, like a healthy, beloved community, to borrow that expression, they enrich and enchant the mundane and kind of call you to higher account, simply because, not just because there are other people watching you, but because there are other people that whose own life course is rests a little bit upon yours. And so I think there is just an element of trying to enchant the mundane with reminding people of the best experiences or communities they've been a part of that left a deep imprint. And then what would it look like to try to seed, to re-thicken, re-enchant the mundane around you? I'm not quite getting at what you say, because it's quite profound. I just spent last week in Paradise, California, which you may, mm-hmm. very ironically named now, you may recall, was utterly decimated, basically eradicated, town of 27,000 by the deadliest fire in California history last November 8th. And I was there, I'd never been before, was there and in this neighboring larger city of Chico, this is super Northern California, and just trying to get a handle on what is the community rebuild looking like 8 months later. And it's just, it's horrific what occurred. It is also one of those classic scenarios of crazy disaster bringing out the best in people and kind of really revealing character and encouraging it. I mean, there were some bad stories in there too of looting and so on, but in general, this is a story of like people across great difference. It's a very purple place politically, or the broader region is purple. And you've got kind of extremes on all, you're watching people, they have no choice but to work together. And I'm still like processing so much, but I was somehow struck by, why is it that we need disaster for like some of the things I'm trying to celebrate in the book to come alive. I think part of my interest in it was, it's rare in this country that we've seen a whole town completely get wiped off the map, in this case by fire, and you have no institutions. So my question was like, well, okay, if you can start from scratch, like, okay, you need a hospital, if you're going to try to recreate or create a fresh, healthy community, so complex, but maybe how could character or sort of moral beauty be a protagonist as you think about what needs to be fundamental building blocks? And anyways, that's like, maybe that's easy for me to ask there in the thick of just trying to survive and, but
It is that interesting place, because I don't live too terribly far from Paradise and the impact that it had on our community, and then hopefully the impact that our community still, is having on Paradise. But I was at this weekend, I was at an event where it was part of the lament of this event. It was a celebration of life event, but it was also this lament of in that community, people connected with Paradise or people connected with some of the other, communities that were impacted by the fires of the last couple of years here in California. It was still the telling of stories and the caring of just even listening to those stories of what's been lost. But then what people discovered, I think through it, one of the interesting comments to me was at this event, as I was talking with the family that had lost, pretty much everything, it was what they went to, what they rediscovered was friendship, family, community, and the all the things that you're getting back into this book, the interconnected nature of people and people's together.
They like rediscovered the fabric. Exactly. That's what people said to me too. I mean, that's like the silver lining, I guess, or like out of disaster, something new has been created, or at least something forgotten has been discovered, maybe is a better way of putting it. It's really interesting.
So, Anne, as we finish up, you're in a period of professional transition, and Comment Magazine is something I love to read, and have, it's been part of my life and a number of my friends' lives as we kind of grow and develop. What can you tell us about, this next stage as you move into, full-time editor in chief at Comment, but then also kind of the growth and opportunity? As we close out our time, like, what are your hopes for Comment and the impact that it can continue to have?
Yeah, well, I'm honestly having the time of my life. I started in May, and it is just like, I'm even giggling saying this out loud. It's just like been the most delicious pairing for me of, I don't know, as an editor, you're a convener and you're trying to discern the times a little bit, but in my case, it's fun not to just be a solo voice, but to actually kind of be this conductor or invisible. I'm like a quiet, invisible conductor of a choir of voices, and just the pairing of kind of the hospitality in that regard with hopefully some intellectual vision to, I think, Comment is a wonderful magazine. I see an amazing opportunity for it right now for a variety of reasons to kind of step into a vacuum that I think has been created in the specifically kind of transcendently oriented, faith-filled, I don't want to say center exactly, because I don't really mean that politically, although there's a political overlay there, but I encounter so many people from so many walks of life and frankly, wide cross-section of demographics, city, urban, urban, rural, suburban, cross race and ethnicity, generation. I find myself meeting so many people who, in the Christian sense, I call it like the church you cannot see. It's like there's a lot of people motivated by faith that are not you know, they're never covered by the press. They're serving in the most out of the way places, but they're often the heartbeat. They're part of a major heartbeat of their communities, and somehow both kind of celebrating the sacred sector, but in a way that's very inviting to those who don't themselves consider God or certainly Christianity to be particularly attractive or valid even. I'm hoping that somehow that my own work the last few years has just given me such an appreciation for people who are practitioners who may not have, you know, they may need a little help edit in their, you know, with their words being edited in the magazine, but I'm hoping to really like blend like high academic, great academic work and the intellectual world with the world of praxis and sort of the community shepherds out there in a whole variety of creative ways in a magazine that will be hopefully broader than before, but in the people represented and the voices and perspectives represented. But carrying on Comet's legacy is just like, I think, a really hope-filled, you know, I would say like Christianly inspired in a kind of creative way. Like Christianity is a vehicle for creative resourcefulness in the world. I'm just hoping to continue that legacy. So anyways, I'll probably answer differently a year from now when I both failed more and hopefully succeeded here or there. But it's just the greatest privilege. I'm just overjoyed.
And I, you know, it's fun having this conversation. It's fun hearing just even you talk about the things that you enjoy and that get you excited. And thank you for spending this time with me today. And I look forward to, you know, just being able to share this conversation with, you know, my friends and with other people. And I look forward to see what happens with your work with Comet too. I'm excited as well.
Thanks, Eric. Thank you.